It's hard for me to imagine because I have grown up with the enemy, and so have you. You understand the word completely because it has surrounded you from the time that you were old enough to understand anything. But it hadn't surrounded her. You see, the concept hadn't really sunk in. I can only imagine it's a word like pain, a word like sorrow, a word like hurt, something that it wouldn't matter how much somebody explained it to you, you wouldn't really understand it until you felt it. You see, that's how I imagine Eve coming to the realization, coming to the horror, the terror of what death really meant. You see, God had promised her, hey, if you eat of the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. She understood that. She had felt the soul-wrenching separation between her and Adam and God, that intimate relationship being torn apart. But I don't believe she fully understood the concept of death until the day that she realized that Abel was never coming back. Until the day that she realized she would never look into Abel's eyes again, never hug the living body of her son, never on this earth again see her own flesh and blood alive. You see, it doesn't matter how much someone tries to prepare you for that concept. It doesn't matter how much someone says, this is going to hurt, this is going to be painful, this is going to be sorrowful. You can use words like that all day long, but until you have experienced it, you don't understand it. Like the word hot. I have a little 20-month-old. We told him some macaroni was hot. He didn't understand the concept. He put it in his mouth. He spit it out and said, he understood it after that. Now anytime we tell him something's hot, before he touches it, he says, death. The Bible says in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 15, that before Christ's entrance into the world, every person, the Bible says, all their lives were subject to bondage because of their fear of death. The enemy. You see, it's the one thing you can't defeat. You can't beat it. You can't have enough money to buy your way out of it. There's no way you can make a deal for it. You can't say, oh, well, I'm smart enough, maybe I'll figure out a way to work around it. I was reading some of the Greek mythology, and some of the individuals there were hailed as so brilliant that they had come up with a way, using their minds to get around death. It's a fairy tale. You can't do it. Doesn't matter how rich you are, doesn't matter how smart you are, doesn't matter how well versed in whatever kind of discipline that you are, it doesn't matter. You don't get out of the war with death. You always lose. Always. And everybody from the time of Adam and Eve until the time that Jesus Christ comes back will lose the fight with death. Oh, you could build walls to keep out wild animals. You could sharpen swords and put on armor to fight other people. But you could not and cannot beat death. Oh, you could not. Until. You see, that verse in Hebrews says that those people were all their lives subject to bondage through fear of death. But Jesus Christ came, the verse says before, and defeated him who had the power of death. That is the devil, and released those who through fear of death were all their lives in bondage. You see, you can. You can beat death. You can change what sin has done, but only one way to do that. There's only one. Now, I dare say if you were sitting at McDonald's and someone that came in, let's say it was yesterday, he came in Bermuda shorts and flip-flops and a pullover shirt, and he stood up on the top of one of the tables and he says, "I need to get everybody's attention in here. I've got a story that's going to change your life." You're eating your Big Mac and some fries. You look up and think this guy is one brick shy of a load. Something's wrong with him, of course. You stop eating just to hear what he's going to say. He stands up and explains to you that about 3 weeks ago, one of his best friends had been hit by a truck. But that friend had been buried in a local cemetery. 3 days after he had been buried in that cemetery, he went to visit his friend's grave. And when he arrived, that grave was empty. And several days later, he had seen his friend, and his friend had talked to him in the flesh. And his friend said that anybody who will climb Mount Kilimanjaro will be able to defeat death, and you've got to climb it by next year. And he was asking everybody in McDonald's to go out and get some hiking gear and make sure they got to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro by next year. Now, what would you think about that? That guy's crazy. That guy's ludicrous. That guy is missing something upstairs. Nobody came back from the grave yesterday or 3 weeks ago or 2 months ago. You wouldn't believe that story for a second. You know, you can flip through the literature, especially in medieval times, and you can read about people who claim that there were resurrections 500 years ago. People that you would consider very superstitious, people who said that this was attributed to something like witchcraft or sorcery, and you could read that, and they would, with all of their hearts, have believed that those resurrections were occurring 500 years ago. Would you believe that? No, you wouldn't. What about 1,000 years ago? Somebody comes forward and says, 1,000 years ago there was a guy who died, who came. Would you believe that? No, you wouldn't. 1,500 years ago, not for a minute. Suppose there's a story about a man almost 2,000 years ago who claimed to be the Son of God, who hung on a cross for 6 hours, was buried in the tomb of a man named Joseph of Arimathea, and 3 days later, he came back from the grave. You wouldn't believe it 500 years ago. You wouldn't believe it 1,000 years ago. You wouldn't believe it 1,500 years ago. But for some reason, every single one of you sitting in this auditorium today has based your life on the fact that a story 2,000 years ago is as true as you're sitting here. Now, why is that? Can you prove the resurrection of Jesus Christ? You know, I regularly deal with the skeptical community. And what I mean by the skeptical community are those atheistic, agnostic people who approach the teachings of the Bible and say, you don't have evidence for this and you are wasting your time, you are ignorant to believe it. They would include all of us in with people who would believe a guy who popped into McDonald's yesterday and told you about a resurrection. That's what they put the resurrection of Jesus Christ on par with. Let you read a statement from a man by the name of Richard Carrier. Richard Carrier wrote this statement in an article he titled, "Why I Don't Buy the Resurrection." He said this, "No amount of argument can convince me to trust a 2,000-year-old secondhand report of what I see myself directly here and now with my own eyes. If I observe facts which entail that I'll cease to exist when I die, then the Jesus story can never override that observation, being infinitely weaker as proof, and yet all the evidence before my senses confirms my mortality." Carey says it doesn't matter what you tell me. There's no amount of argument, no amount of explanation, no amount of historical documentation, no amount of evidence that you could present to me that will ever convince me that the resurrection is true, and here's why. I've never seen anybody rise from the dead. And because I've never seen anybody rise from the dead, I would never believe in a resurrection regardless of the historical proof that you provide. Now, on the surface, this seems like a pretty decent thinking as far as he says, I'm only going to accept those things that I have seen. But he's not telling you the truth. You see, there's not a person in the world that only accepts those things that they have seen. If you were to ask Mr. Carrier, an atheist, how in the world did life arise on this planet? You know what he would tell you? He would say that multiplied millions of years ago, there was some primordial slime that consisted of non-living chemicals. And then some type of energy force hit those non-living chemicals and turned those non-living chemicals into the first single-celled life. When you were to ask Mr. Carrier, have you ever seen non-living chemicals turn into life? Have you ever seen a process by which chemicals that have no animate process or virtue at all somehow are turned into life? You know what he would tell you? No, I've never seen that. Do you believe it? Yeah, I believe it. Have you ever seen it? No, you've never seen it. When you press the people who claim to take this at face value, they cannot maintain that because ultimately they have to conclude that there are some things that they have never seen that were reality. If you were to ask them about their beloved Big Bang, which is scientifically as false can be, but if you were to ask them, have you ever seen an explosion of a piece of material that can be infinitely dense? That's what they suggest it was, infinitely dense. When you ask them to unpack the term infinitely dense, they quickly explain to you that, well, we've never seen anything infinitely dense. Well, I thought, Mr. Carey, that you were telling us that you only accept things that you see, and yet you've never seen life come from non-life. You've never seen anything infinitely dense. You've never seen an explosion that could bring the universe into existence like the one that you propose. You could go down the list of 100 things that they suggest to you that they've never seen. This idea is false. Now, I'll tell you why Richard Carrier doesn't buy the resurrection. He doesn't believe there's a God. You see, once you prove that there is a God, and we can do that, we don't have time to do that this morning, but the evidence is overwhelming and abundant and very convincing to any honest assessor of it. Once you prove that there is a God, if you were to ask the question, how in the world would God explain to people that there was a message or a person that he wanted you to know was from him, it would make perfect logical sense to conclude that God would use miraculous intervention to prove that this message or this person is something superhuman, something above nature, something divine, something from God. Now, let me show you the other problem with Richard Carrier's assessment here. Let's say that last week you went to the hospital, you were visiting somebody, they died. They stayed in the hospital for 3 or 4 days, their dead body lying there in that bed, and then they came back to life. Let's say 2 weeks or 3 weeks before that, the same thing occurred. 2 weeks or 3 weeks before that, the same thing occurred. Let's say it was a fairly common practice that people came back from the dead. Now, if you were to suggest that Jesus Christ was the Son of God because he came back from the dead, and you were to present that to skeptics like Richard Carrier, and you said, well, Jesus Christ was the Son of God because he came back from the dead, what would his answer be to that? Oh, people come back from the dead all the time. That's no proof of anything. Do you see what he has done as a skeptic here? He has said, there's no way you can prove it to me because, number one, if it happens all the time, then it's not important if Jesus did it. But number two, I'm not going to accept it unless I see it. So if you see it, it's not going to be proof because people do it all the time. But if you don't see it, it's not going to be proof because, well, he's just given himself any way out so that there's no possible way that you can prove this to him because he's already decided he's not going to believe it regardless of the evidence. Now, as we work through this idea of the resurrection, he says a 2,000-year-old secondhand tale from the backwaters of an illiterate and ignorant land can never overpower these facts. I see no one returning to life after their brain has completely died from the lack of oxygen. I have had no conversations with spirits of the dead. What I see is quite the opposite of everything this tall tale claims. How can it command more respect than my own two eyes? It cannot. Well, I'm here to suggest to you this morning that it certainly can and absolutely positively should. And I'm going to show you that it is a fact. Could miracles happen? Absolutely, miracles can happen. If there is a God, then you understand that that is exactly what you would expect that God to do, to communicate to you the message. Now here's your question. How important is the resurrection? I mean, what's it matter? You know, there are lots of people that say the resurrection doesn't matter, really. It doesn't matter if you prove to me that Jesus Christ didn't come back from the grave. It's a moral tale anyway, and all I need to know is the theological importance of if it was a possibility. You know, there are lots of liberal Bible scholars who would suggest to you that they're Christians. They would say, oh yes, I'm a Christian. But when you ask them, what do you mean that you're a Christian? Does that mean you believe that the resurrection actually happened? They would say, no, I don't believe that it actually happened, but I believe the spiritual point of the resurrection is important. Well, they have totally misunderstood the reading from Scripture that we had just this morning that you will find in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 14 and 17. The brother read for us the entirety of that. I'll just focus on the first and last verse of that. If Christ is not risen, then our preaching is empty and your faith is also empty. If Christ is not risen, your faith is futile. You're still in your sins. Your life depends on the fact that Jesus Christ's physical body came out of that tomb. Everything that you've ever done, thought, or said in relation to your spiritual life means absolutely positively nothing if someone could prove that Jesus Christ's body was still in that tomb 3 days after His death. It doesn't matter how spiritual you try to make it. It doesn't matter how surreal you try to surround the idea, how theological you try to put the concept of, well, you know, maybe if Jesus didn't rise, it still has some meaning. No, it doesn't. If Jesus didn't come back from the grave, the Bible has zero meaning whatsoever. It's useless to you. And as Paul said, if Jesus Christ didn't come back from the grave, we as Christians are of all men the most pitiable. But if He did, you see, if He did, then we have found the only possible way to defeat death. We have it. Can we prove that the resurrection happened? That the resurrection occurred? Oh, sure, absolutely. This is not a subject, and when I say not a subject for debate, what I mean by that is this. If you were to lay out the evidence for the resurrection's occurrence to a person who had never heard the story, who was unbiased by a culture of skepticism, and if you were just to put it before them and say, here is the evidence that we have for it, do you believe it? If they're honest, they will come to the overwhelming conclusion that, yes, I believe it. This is true. There's no way it can't be true. If you were to say, what are some of the evidences that nailed down for us the fact that Jesus Christ came back from the grave, you would have to start with the fact that it's recorded in the most historically reliable documents ever to exist in the world. And here's what I mean by that. If the New Testament documents say that Pontius Pilate was the prefect of Judea, if you can go to any of the Roman historical records and you can find any mention of that time period, you will find when they mention who was the ruler of Judea, it will say Pontius Pilate, exactly like the New Testament document said. If the New Testament documents dealt with topography, where it says a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and you were to look at that and you were to say, well, he's not going south, but it actually is going down, the word is there, meaning he went down 3,000 feet below sea level from Jerusalem to Jericho. Every time it makes a topographical statement, it's exactly right. It's exactly right. Every time it makes a geographical statement and it says a certain island was a certain distance from another place, or a certain place was a certain wherever from this other town or this other village, every single time, it's exactly right. A man by the name of Sir William Ramsay decided he was going to disprove the book of Acts. He went over to Asia Minor with a proverbial archaeological pick, started looking for all of those things that the book of Acts said. He was looking for them because he didn't think that he would find them. He thought that when he got there, he would find so many errors, he could write the definitive book on the ridiculousness of the book of Acts. after he got finished looking at all of the places in Asia Minor, going through Acts as a map, he realized that whoever wrote the book of Acts, it being Luke, was a historian of top rank. In fact, he put a book out. The book was supposed to refute the book of Acts. But instead of doing that, the book, in glowing terms, said that the person who wrote Acts, Luke, the historian, is the most remarkable historian that anybody's ever seen, and he doesn't make mistakes. It's the most historically reliable set of documents in the world. So here's what that means. When it says anything about Pontius Pilate, it's true. When it says anything about the Pool of Bethesda, it's true. When it says anything about Asia Minor, when it says anything about any city, when it says anything about any country, any person who was in charge of a certain place, it's true, 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 true. When it says something about the resurrection, it's what? Well, the skeptic says it's not true. Why? Because it's less historically documented than all the other stuff? No. Because you have a prejudice against miracles to start out with. That's the only reason. You see, if you take the most historically reliable documents and every single thing that they say proves to be right, you can't dismiss the resurrection just because you have a bias against this happening. You have to put it in with all of the other statements and recognize that if all of these other statements are true, the same validity that backs those backs the resurrection. And so it's included in the most historically reliable documents in the world, and that cannot be gainsaid. That is a fact of scholarship that can be nailed down with no argument. Continue with me. People will say, yes, well, okay, maybe some of the documents are historically reliable, but don't they disagree? I mean, you've got statements in one of the gospel accounts that says this. You've got statements in another gospel account that says that. In fact, Dan Barker, the man that I debated in February, said that you have such disagreement among the gospel accounts and Paul that you have an embarrassing multitude of writers that disagree about the resurrection. I'm going to show you how his statement gets him in trouble, but let me give you an example of what he would call and what the skeptical community would call contradictions. If you were to read Matthew chapter 28 verse 1, you would read the following. Now after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to the tomb. Now let me ask you a very simple question. According to this verse, who came to the tomb? Mary Magdalene and the other Mary. If we were taking a test where we were to write in, according to Matthew 28:1, who came to the tomb? Mary Magdalene, the other Mary. Now let's go for this verse. Mark chapter 16, verse 1. Now when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome. Are those two statements different? Yeah, sure, they're very different. In fact, one of them says Salome, one of them doesn't say anything about Salome. Look at John chapter 20, verse 1. On the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb. The skeptic looks at this and says, look, you can't say that the resurrection is recorded in the most historically reliable documents because, yeah, it might be right about all those islands and all that stuff, but when you put them together, they don't say the same thing. You can't reconcile these. They're contradictory. In fact, this is often used as one of the most powerful proofs against the validity of the resurrection. It's ridiculous. I'm going to show you how ridiculous. Suppose that you go to the mall. Suppose it's a man going with his wife. One of his buddies calls him after that and says, hey, what'd you do today? He says, oh, I went to the mall. I went to one of the hunting stores there in the mall and got a new deer grunt call, and I got a new camouflage hat, and then we stopped at Cinnabon and had one of those big cinnamon rolls. It was a great day. Now, let's say one of the wife's friends calls her and says, what'd you do today? She says, oh, I went to the mall with my husband. Now, the husband didn't mention that he went with his wife. Does that mean he was lying? Does that mean he was wrong? Does that mean that their statements are contradictory just because he didn't mention that he went with his wife? Now suppose that the wife's friend continues to ask her what happened, and she says, oh, I stopped at Gap and I got the grandkids some $3.99 pajamas, and then my husband and I, he took me into Dillard's and we got some new perfume, and it was a great day. Now she mentioned Dillard's, Gap, and new perfume and going with her husband. And that's what a girl would think about from what I know about girls. Not a whole lot of it. I have been married 10 years. Almost 10. November 11th. December the 11th. See, put that on record. December 11th. Make sure I don't get that. See if my wife's listening to that. Now, she mentions perfume. She mentions Gap pajamas. And she mentions going with her husband, and yet the husband doesn't mention anything about those things. Are those contradictory statements? No, they're not contradictory. Are they different? Yeah. Now, why in the world would the Bible writers write different things? There are a couple reasons. Number one, suppose that I told you today that I got an email from Josh Ketchum. Who cares to you guys? Y'all know who Josh Ketchum is. That doesn't mean one thing to you. Now suppose I said I got an email from Dan Jenkins. Well, now that means something else because you know who Dan Jenkins is. Now suppose that I'm talking to an audience that doesn't have a clue who Josh Ketchum is, but they do know who Dan Jenkins is, and so I mention Dan and I don't mention Josh. Does that mean if I go somewhere else and say that on the same day I got an email from Josh Ketchum, that those statements are contradictory? No, they're not contradictory. They're different. Now, watch what God has done. Do you know what the word collusion means? Collusion means a secret agreement between two or more parties for a fraudulent, illegal, or deceitful purpose. Suppose that there were some robbers who knocked off a bank, and they knew the police were going to come to their house, and so they got together and came up with a story that all sounded exactly the same. We were at Tom's house from 8 to 12, playing cards. Knock on the first door, Tom's house, 8 to 12, playing cards. Second door, Tom's house, 8 to 12, playing cards. Third door, Tom's house, 8 to 12, playing cards. Fourth door, Tom's house, 8 to 12, playing cards. Do all those statements agree? Oh, sure. Not a difference in any of them. Are they false? Yeah. But they agree. Do you know what the skeptic says when we find passages in the Bible that sound very similar to each other, like the book of Jude and 2 Peter chapter 2? You know what the skeptic says? Those are very similar statements, and so the skeptic says, well, Jude just copied Peter. Or Peter just copied Jude. If every single one of the gospel accounts sounded exactly the same, what would the skeptic say? Oh, they just copied each other. So what has God done so that they can't say that? Well, you can't say that John copied Matthew because John mentions Mary Magdalene, but Matthew mentions Mary and the other Mary. You can't say Mark copied John because Mark mentioned Salome and John didn't say anything about Salome. You know what God has done? He has made the statement that Dan Barker made half right. Dan Barker said, you've got a multitude of witnesses. But he said, well, you have a multitude of witnesses that contradict each other, and it's an embarrassing multitude, but when you realize that they don't contradict each other, then Barker has to admit, and so do all the rest of the skeptics, you've got a bunch of different testimony here. Not just one, but a multitude of witnesses, which would have made the resurrection testimony much more powerful. Continue with me. The resurrection was foretold. You know, it's something to say that someone rose from the grave. In fact, that wasn't novel. Necessarily. You had some people in the Old Testament come back from the grave. You had Lazarus and the widow of Nain's son come back from the grave in the New Testament. I'll tell you what was novel. 1,000 years before this ever happened, the psalmist wrote that God would not leave His Holy One's body in Sheol or soul in Sheol, and He wouldn't let His body see corruption. 1,000 years before it occurred, it was predicted. Jesus Christ Himself predicted it so clearly that His enemies go to Pontius Pilate and they say, this deceiver said that after He died, He would come back from the grave. They understood Jesus' prediction so well that they begged Pilate for soldiers to place at the tomb so that Jesus' prediction of His own resurrection could not come true. Did Jesus Christ predict He would come back from the grave? Yes. Destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it again. He said He laid down His life, but He had the power to take it up again. His enemies knew exactly what He was saying. It was so clear to them that they tried to stop it. Just as an aside, you don't stop the plans of God. Though the nations rage and plot together vain things, they don't alter God's plans. You see, it was predicted. You see that the tomb was empty. Now, working with the skeptical community, lots of times you have to go outside of the New Testament to present to them evidence that is more palatable to them. The truth is, you could just take the New Testament documents, they stand for themselves, and you could present it, but that's not all we have, so I wanted to present this to you. This is a letter from the Sanhedrin that is not inspired. It's not in your New Testament documents. It is recorded by early Christian writers. And here's what the Sanhedrin wrote. A godless and lawless heresy had sprung up from one Jesus, a Galilean deceiver, whom we crucified, but his disciples stole him by night from the tomb where he was laid when unfastened from the cross, and now deceive men by asserting that he's risen from the dead and ascended to heaven. A couple things about this. What does it admit? Well, there's no body in the tomb. His body's gone. Now, let's look at the answer they gave for why there's nobody in the tomb. You know all they would have had to have done to stop Christianity in its tracks? To have halted it immediately without any further problems to the Jewish religion? All they would have had to have done is go down to the tomb of Jesus and say, here's his body, be quiet. And that would have worked. But they couldn't. And so they concocted this story, and here's what they said. Well, number one, his disciples stole him. While the soldiers were sleeping. What happens when you're asleep? I mean, how much do you know about what happens when you're asleep? Unfortunately, I slept through a lot of classes at Freed Hardeman. And didn't do me one lick of good knowing what was going on while I was sleeping during those classes. I've come to see the error of my ways, and I have stayed awake for almost every single one of these lectures now. I wish all of you could say the same thing, but unfortunately, what I've seen you... No, I'm just kidding. You know what happens when you fall asleep? If the soldiers that were guarding the tomb had fallen asleep, they wouldn't have known if the body sprouted wings and flew out, or if his disciples stole him, or why in the world would they suggest that his disciples stole him? How would they have known it was his disciples? They were asleep. And now something just a little bit more realistic here. The women were coming to the tomb wondering how they were going to move a several hundred pound stone. You mean to tell me that those soldiers slept while his disciples moved a several hundred pound stone and they didn't even budge? That's ridiculous. And also, you know what happened to soldiers if they fell asleep on their watch? From what I understand about the Romans, you were supposed to, if you were their fellow soldier, set them on fire. If you walked by one of your fellow Roman soldiers and you saw that he was sleeping, you were supposed to set him on fire and hopefully he died. Because if he didn't die, lots of times he was going to be killed by the officials in charge. Maybe you recall when Herod had captured Peter and the angel had gone into the prison. I always think it's a very interesting story that it looks like the angel kicks Peter on the side, says, get up. Peter gets up, he goes out of the prison. The next day Herod comes to call for Peter. Peter's not there. He interrogates the guards and then kills them. Maybe you'll recall the Philippian jailer. He goes in after the earthquake. He sees that all the doors are open, sees that the chains are loosed. He pulls out a sword. He's about to kill himself because he might as well do it before the Romans do, because that's what happens to a soldier who loses his charges. And you mean to tell me that there were soldiers at the tomb of Jesus for the express purpose of staying awake so that nobody stole the body, and yet they fell asleep but weren't woken up by somebody moving a 300-pound rock, and then nothing happened to them when they were investigated for their lapse of soldierly judgment? You know why this didn't stop people from becoming Christians on the day of Pentecost? It's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. Anybody who had been around at the time of this would have seen right through the absurdity of this suggestion. But the tomb was empty, so you had to come up with something. Do you know why Peter stood in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost? He pointed his finger at all of those people and said, you killed Jesus. And God rose him from the grave. And I'm right here in the middle of Jerusalem. The tomb's just a little bit down the way. If you don't believe me, go check. Go see for yourself. See if that tomb is empty. Continue with me. The resurrection is confirmed by eyewitness accounts. And here's what I mean by that. 2 Peter, chapter 1, verse 16, for we did not follow cunningly devised fables, but were eyewitnesses of His majesty. Maybe you'll recall that one of the biggest jobs for an apostle at the very beginning of Acts, when Peter was explaining to the other apostles that they needed to replace Judas, one of the major criteria for becoming an apostle was one who had seen the resurrected Lord and had gone in and out among them from the time of John the Baptizer's baptizing Jesus. What was the purpose of being an apostle? To be a witness to the resurrection of Jesus. Folks, these people were eyewitnesses. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul says, I delivered to you that which I also received, that Jesus Christ died according to the Scriptures, was buried according to the Scriptures, rose on the third day according to the Scriptures, and he was seen by the 12, and he was seen by James, and he was seen by over 500 brethren, the bulk of which remain until this day. And he was seen also by me as one born out of due time. Paul, do you mean to tell me that you saw Jesus Christ? Yeah, I saw him. There are 500 brethren who saw him? Yeah, you can go ask them if you want. You know what else, though, about this eyewitness testimony? It's one thing to testify to a fact. It's another thing entirely for someone to say, if you don't withdraw that fact, I'm going to kill you. You see, not only were the apostles eyewitnesses of the testimony, but when the Roman officials said, we're going to behead you if you don't change, they said, fine, I know that I've seen Jesus. When the Roman officials said, we're going to kill you with a sword if you don't recant your testimony, the apostles said, fine, I know I've seen Jesus. When the Roman officials said, we're going to burn you at the stake if you don't say that you're lying, the apostles said, fine, I know I'm not lying. I've seen Jesus. Not just I've seen Jesus. I saw him die. And I saw his resurrected body. And he promised me that if I would be true to death, I'd get one of those. Those resurrected bodies, the kind that you can't beat, the kind that no sword, no spear, no flame, no wild animal, the kind that can't be taken away from me, the kind that demolishes humanity's fear of death. I saw Jesus have one. He beat you. And so can I. Romans chapter 6 says that, don't you know that as many of us as are baptized into Christ are baptized into His death? That just as Jesus Christ was raised from the dead, so we come out of that watery grave of baptism as a resurrected person in the Spirit with a guarantee of a resurrection in the body. Do you know what the beauty of the resurrection is? The beauty of it. The beauty of it is this. If there were a person that were to storm into this auditorium this morning with an automatic weapon and fire off a bunch of rounds into the ceiling and were to come up to you personally and stick that cold steel barrel right to your temple and to ask you a simple question, do you believe that Jesus Christ came back from the dead? Folks, your physical life's riding on the question. You know, the only way that you can be confident in a scenario like that is to know for a fact, that Jesus Christ rose from the grave. And wouldn't it be marvelous if every person in this auditorium had the confidence and the assurance for their dying breath to be, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and I know He came back from the grave, and so will I. So will I. If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, this morning, if you need to have a confidence in the face of death that Jesus Christ had and that all of His apostles and disciples and true followers have had from the time that He defeated death, I hope you'll respond to the Lord's invitation this morning as we stand and as we sing.